I have a very positive opinion about Uncle Bobby. He made a lot of money, and I think he did it honestly. He dodged a lot of taxes, which I always respect legally, and he got the money into the hands of the province of Prince Edward Island for the benefit of Islanders, and the evidence is in. It's working.
Robert L. Cotton was a quirky, bowler hat-wearing World War I veteran with a strong aversion to sending his hard-earned tax dollars to Ottawa. By trade, he was a contractor who brought the rent-to-own concept to PEI, allowing hundreds of Islanders to own their first home. But it's what he did with his money that stands the test of time. During his lifetime, Bobby Cotton established trusts, which in today's dollars would be valued at more than $13 million. Annual proceeds have funded everything from scholarships at Holland College, construction of the Charlevoix Boardwalk, development of the former provincial tree nursery in Bunbury, provincial parks in Brudenell and Strathgartney, Confederation Center Art Gallery, and hundreds of community projects over the past 50 plus years. There should be a statue to Bobby Cotton. So immense is his contribution to island life. His legacy of generosity is virtually unmatched in island history, yet few know of him. We're going to change that. Noted Charlevoix businessman Fred Hindman is Bobby Cotton's nephew. Today he joins us to talk about the amazing life lived by his uncle, his vision, and his impact on PEI for generations to come. Right off the top, let me give thanks to our show sponsor, Robin's Donuts. Locally owned and operated by noted island businessman Kent Scales, with 13 outlets ready to serve you across PEI. Make sure you drop by Robin's Donuts today. Fred Hindman, welcome to Because Life is Local.
Glad to be here.
Tell me about your connection to Robert L. Cotton.
Well, Paul, it starts with a family relationship. Robert Cotton was a brother to my late grandmother, and he lived nearby to us, and it was a very tight family, so my connection was through the family. And as a result, I knew of him and knew him all my life.
It's a little unfortunate that more Islanders don't know about Robert L. Cotton. We hear things like Cotton Memorial Trust or Cotton Park. We know a name, but we don't know the individual and his generosity towards this province. I think you indicated in a speech that you gave to Rotary, Charlevoix Rotary, a good number of years ago, that on sort of an inflation-adjusted basis, he made donations that in today's dollars would total something over $13 million.
Yes, he did. And he did it quietly. Never did it anonymously, that I'm aware. But he didn't really seek out any particular recognition. And his name very seldom appeared with the result of some of those endowments that he left. He was a very, he was a private man, a modest man, very hardworking. He was extremely generous with a long-sighted view of the future of this province, which I think is another remarkable aspect of his work.
Let's go back and just sort of introduce folks to Bobby Cotton. He was known as Bobby. He was born 1888 or something around there.
Yes, he was born in Charlottetown, and I'm sure you've looked up the date. And yet, the other thing was, yes, he was known to young and old as Bobby Cotton, until the day he died.
And how did he make a living?
Well, he was in the...
Veteran of the First World War, by the way.
Correct? Yeah, he had, first of all, I guess he was one of a fairly large family, grew up in Charlottetown. His father was publisher of the Examiner, then the leading newspaper in Prince Edward Island, and they weren't rich, but they lived a reasonably comfortable life, from what I can tell. And he was one of, I think, six or seven children, and he was well educated for the time. He went through the Charlottetown school system and then did spend 1 year at King's College in Nova Scotia, which was a bonus that many people did not enjoy. So then he came back to the island, I think with an intention of going into the newspaper business with his father, but the First World War intervened, and so that did not happen.
He could have been an officer, you've indicated, in the First World War, but chose not to. Tell us why.
Well, I love this little yarn that my mother often repeated, and that was that when the First World War was on, of course, they were recruiting people to go and fight on behalf of king and country, and he was very eager to do that, and he looked into the recruiting system, and he had the educational qualifications he could have applied for and probably been granted a commission to become an officer in the army, or he could apply to become a private foot soldier, and he chose the latter because he learned that if you become a commissioned officer, you were expected to purchase your own uniforms. And Bobby Cotton was then, and through all his life, I think the polite word is parsimonious. He couldn't see the merit of paying for a uniform, so he became a private and did in fact go overseas and fought in the First World War.
It also speaks to his risk-taking, his tolerance for risk, which, you know, seems to be prevalent throughout his career and life.
Well, it sure does, because if he was going to be a foot soldier, that pretty much meant service in the trenches, which was a very dangerous occupation. Whereas if he was going to be a field officer, he would probably be less dangerously exposed, and the casualty rate was far lower for officers than it was for other ranks.
Now, he returned to PEI, and he decided to start a career, and he saw an opportunity. Banks didn't provide mortgages at that time.
Yeah, I think there's one other little bit of Bobby's life that is important. After the war, he didn't come directly home after he was demobilized. He stayed on in Britain for a time, and I'm not sure how long, but it was probably a couple of years. And he liked many things that he found in Britain, and he acquired a great appreciation for horticulture, which he saw in England, where horticulture was a high art form in those days, the cultivation of trees of various species, of beautiful flowers and roses and all those things. And public gardens in Britain were then great attractions, and people went, and he did, and he saw things, and he said, by golly, he liked what he saw. And parks, he liked parks, and Britain was advancing parks in that, this would be in 1920 approximately. And so he stayed on in England for, I'm not sure of the time, but let's say 2 years. And he learned about things there. He also learned about another thing, which was a terminology that's used in England to this day called hire purchase. We're not familiar with that term here. A hire purchase means you agree to pay so much monthly, periodically, and at the end of the period, you own the object that you wanted. And it applied to housing. And that seemed to be a very progressive thing in his mind, because it was a problem at home. He knew it was a very, very serious problem for people to raise money to build their own homes. So he came home to Prince Edward Island with some of these ideas rolling around in his mind. And he commenced the development business. He was building houses and building buildings and construction. And that's what he did for a living.
Homes for the everyman.
That's what the way it came down. He built no large, fancy houses for well-off people. He built very modest, small houses, which he offered to the public on what would be called in England hire purchase, or sometimes called rent to purchase. And that was very important because until 1970 something or other, or the 1960s or 70s, Canadian banks were legally prohibited from loaning money to people on the security of their home. It was against the banking regulations. So where did people borrow money to build a home? Well, some might be fortunate to have a rich uncle or somebody who they would be helped by. Others would go to a lawyer's office, and the lawyer often had an estate he was administering, and you might raise a loan there. And there were a few trust companies that did a little bit of mortgage financing. But back in the 1920s, that was very, very rare. So when Bobby had these houses, which he would offer at a monthly rental, on the promise that, after so many years, a portion of the rent would be credited toward the purchase price. So, yes, he did, and there were many, many houses he built. I have no idea how many, but I'd say in the hundreds around Charlottetown. And it was really a wonderful thing because people were able to buy a very modest home, but it was theirs, and raise their families, and with all the benefits of home ownership, as opposed to living with in-laws and so on.
And some of those homes are still around today in certain neighborhoods in Charlottetown, are they not?
Remarkably, many of them are. And every time I walk by a street of Bobby Cotton houses, I do think they've all been improved. Paul, it's very difficult to find one that's original. I know of a couple, but most of them have been added to, improved, and so on. And they're nice homes today.
What made a Bobby Cotton home?
Well, first of all, it was small. Secondly, it was probably built of used lumber. The insulation was corrugated cardboard. The roofing was roll roofing. And the interior finish would be a 10 test, or it was very plain, very, very plain, but serviceable. And all of the houses they were all different, slightly different. He used design elements that are repeated and repeated, but all in different combinations. So if you walk down a neighborhood of Bobby Cotton houses, you can recognize that, yes, they're related to one another, but they're all different. And there's a couple of neighborhoods in Charlottetown that are still recognizable. One of the nicest is on Desperate Crescent, where there's a range of probably 20 Bobby Cotton houses, half of which are very recognizable, haven't changed a huge amount. I walked by there the other day. And there are numerous neighborhoods. He built many, many houses, and he sold many of them, but not all of them. He sold many of them on hire purchase.
And then his fortunes really took a turn when he made a bet, basically between himself and the federal government's actions. Can you tell me about Alberta and Bobby Cotton?
Well, through his time doing property development and other things, he had other business enterprises as well, he made a lot of money. And he was concerned about taxation. He didn't like taxes at all. And he was particularly concerned about the federal estate tax, which then was levied in Canada. And He and his wife had no children, so he realized that upon their passing, their estate would be hit with very, very heavy, federally levied estate taxes or succession duties. And that meant that his money was, or a good chunk of his money was going to go to Ottawa. And he did not think kindly of that idea, because he just figured that Ottawa would pour that money down a rat hole, as he would describe it, for a cause that he would not wish to support. And furthermore, he wanted the money to stay on PEI, to be invested in building up PEI, which is where he had earned his money and where he had been raised, and he was a great patriot for the future prosperity and progress of PEI. So he had a simple, very simple idea. He said, cut Ottawa out of the deal and let my money go to work on PEI for the benefit of the economy and Prince Edward Islanders in general. And that is exactly what he did. And when he died, the money was all in PEI.
So he set up, during his lifetime, he and his wife Gertrude, set up four trusts, the first being in 1945-ish, and then three more in the 1960s. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I think there were more. Some of them, I'm not sure how many there were. I do know of four or five. I believe the first trust was the Vocational Education Trust, which was very unique and shows, and really, I think, shows the progressivity of the man, how he was thinking ahead. By this time, the Second World War had ended, and there were many soldiers who were coming home from the war who had left here, age 17, 18, 19, gone overseas for 3-4 years, fought in the war. If they hadn't been killed or injured, they were coming home with no training, no education, no job. And what were they to do? The country, the economy, was also coming off and going through a transition from being a war economy to what would be a peacetime economy. So I presume it must have been a time of great concern and uncertainty. So in any event, he reckoned that some of these young people needed education in trades. And there really weren't very many facilities for that in PEI. And the government of the day, which would have been the Walter Jones government, they decided they were going to build a vocational school, which indeed was built on Grafton Street, at just the rear of Prince of Wales College. So it was a brand new building put up. And Bobby Cotton went and he put forward an endowment to fund scholarships for young people.
$100,000.
It was $100,000 in 1946 or 7, right, which was a pile of money in those days. And I thought it was very progressive, because it was for vocational training, not for university or all those things, which are usually the beneficiary of someone's generosity.
Holland College is still giving out, and will give out forever, Cotton scholarships.
They would have this, well, I don't suppose they had a convocation this spring, but yes, they would be awarded, and they'll be awarded next fall.
Let me say a word of thanks to our sponsor today, Robin's Donuts. There are 13 Robin's Donuts across PEI serving up the tastiest coffee and baked goods, made fresh daily. Even the eggs on Robin's breakfast sandwiches are fresh cracked, never frozen. In these difficult times, it's important to support those who support you. And owner Kent Scales and his team are second to none in supporting island communities. So make sure you stop by Robin's Donuts today. So can you tell me the Alberta story? Because in large part, this was also one of the ways that Robert Cotton generated a lot of the cash that he ultimately had to give back to Islanders, or wanted to give back to Islanders.
Well, as having become somewhat wealthy through his work, he had money to invest. And I don't know much about that other than I'm told he was a very canny investor. He was a very smart man. And the province of Alberta was in dire financial condition in the late 1930s and early 40s, and so much so that they failed to pay interest on their provincial bonds, which is a deadly sin in provincial financings. So the result was their Alberta bonds became what we now call junk bonds, and they could be purchased for a fraction of their face value on the open market. And Bobby Cotton, he was aware of all this stuff, and he must have said to himself, Alberta is not going to default on its bonds, or if they were in that perilous position, the federal government will never let them default on their bonds, because it would reflect very, very poorly on all of Canada if a Canadian province did not honor its bonds. So he said, based on his belief that Alberta would not default, or the federal government might back them up, he invested a large amount of his available monies in Alberta bonds, which he bought for a fraction of their value on the open market. And he was holding them, smiling as always, because he was always smiling. And then, by darn, in 1947 or 8, in Leduc, Alberta, they struck oil. And guess what? The bonds immediately went to 100% of value, and he was able to sell them all at 100 cents on the dollar, and apparently made a very significant lift off that, which in those days there was no capital gains tax, so there you are. So he took a gamble on Alberta bonds, probably very well thought out, I would think, and he was right, and it paid off handsomely for him.
So in the 1960s, he and his wife, he's got a stash of cash. He's got his experience in Britain after World War II when he discovered public parks and horticulture. And he's looking how to create some trusts. And one of them was the Cotton Trust for Rural Beautification.
Yes, he I think what precedes that, though, Paul, is, and we haven't mentioned, is other than building houses, which I think was his main occupation, he also was in the tourist business. He was really a pioneer in the tourist business. And he had established Charlottetown Resorts Limited, which was developing vacation area of cottages and hotel, etc., over in the Rocky Point, Holland Cove area across the harbor. And he, with others, had bought large amounts of land and had really very extensive plans for the building of resorts, which they intended to cater to well-off people from the big cities who, in those days, this would be 1920s, wanted to get out of big cities in the summertime because they were unhealthy places with no air conditioning. And so he did build at Holland Cove Resort, which had approximately 20 cottages, a central dining hall, tennis courts, nine-hole golf course.
What year are we talking here?
The 20s.
1920s.
And the resort was very sophisticated for its time. And indeed, it did attract visitors from Boston States and Montreal, Toronto, those places. And people would come for a month or two for the summer. And I do know, in one instance, the president of McGill University brought his family there for several years as an example. It was, you know, really top drawer people. And it was a top drawer resort early on. He perceived that there was going to be great value in tourist business in for Prince Edward Island going forward. The vistas and landscapes, clean air, which was very much valued in those days by people in big cities. And he just thought the PEI had much to offer. One of the things he wanted to enhance was the appearances of the place. And he therefore got in very interested in going back to his horticultural thing experiences in England that we needed here. We needed to be planting better quality of tree stocks. We needed to develop an interest in gardens and flowers and all that sort of cultivation. And he did it himself. In fact, he first established a little plantation of trees and seedlings and so forth for his own use and for the houses and subdivisions that he was building, and also for the resort. And he had that little plantation over in Fairview, near Brocky Point. And then he decided it was needed on a more public basis, so he did a big endowment for the establishment of the Gertrude Cotton Memorial Nursery, I think was the proper name, which is located at the head of the bridge in Southport, now Stratford. And what he did, Paul, as my understanding is, what he did was he went and he bought the land. He constructed several buildings, including the keeper's house. He recruited Mr. Snezell, who was an experienced a gardener from England. And he went to the provincial government and laid on them an endowment for the ongoing maintenance and operation of the thing, all for the purpose of having a good quality planting stock of trees, flowers, fruit trees, etc., available to the people of Prince Edward Island at modest cost. Prior to that, there were no nurseries here, and people could only get these sorts of things by mail order from Ontario at fairly prohibitive cost. So it was the thing was developed, became extremely successful because the people of PEI, they liked what they got, and they planted good quality things, and the visage of PEI was enhanced. Oh, it was very successful. Now then, later, many years later, commercial nurseries came into being in the last 25 years. And the day came when the province of Prince Edward Island said, we really don't need to have a government nursery anymore. That need is being fulfilled by various commercial interests. And so they closed the nursery.
In Bunbury,
as a publicly operated enterprise. And when that happened, I thought, okay, fair enough. I'd say Uncle Bobby's wishes had been fulfilled. And then the sequel to that, of course, next was, what's going to happen to the land? Because I think there must have been 5 or 6 or 8 acres there. And the government of the day decided it would be a great place to build houses. And some of the officials from Stratford came to see me. And they said, what do you know about Bobby Cotton? And they explained. They were concerned that this land was going to be just subdivided and sold. And I said, he'd roll in his grave if he knew that. I said, that land is for public investment, public enjoyment. And if a nursery's not needed, fair enough. But I said, one of the other big things was that he had in his mind was parks. And I said, I think it would make a first-class park, which, of course, now it has done, because Stratford went and made noise with the provincial government and said, no, 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 we want that land for Stratford's park. And that's what it is today.
But Bobby Cotton was a visionary in terms of, you know, he bought land that ultimately became provincial parks in Brudenell and Strathgartney. Tell me about what would motivate him to do something like that. Where does the love, is it love of province? Is it love of sort of taking tax dollars out of Ottawa's pocket? Is it love of green space?
All of the above. A keen interest in the development of the tourism industry in Prince Edward Island. He spoke about that quite often. Because unfortunately, the resort in Holland Cove failed. But it failed because of the Great Depression in 1935. And then the Second World War came along. So there was a period of 15 years when not much was happening because of the war and the depression and so forth. But even though it had failed, his interest did not wane. And the appetite for tourism, the market was changing as society was changing. So I would say he had a continuing belief that the tourism industry could become a big thing around for the island, even after his own effort had failed in the 1930s. So it was that, but there was the business he wanted to keep the money on PEI. And that's not a bad objective.
If you look at some of the communities that have benefited from Cotton Trust money, from one of the four or five trusts that were established, which by the way also includes one for Confederation Center Art Gallery, you're hard-pressed to find a community that hasn't received some type of funding at some point in time. Large communities, small communities, the Charlottetown Boardwalk is there in large part because it received Cotton money.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think your Uncle Bobby would think about his continuing influence on island way of life and culture?
I don't know. You know, I think he'd be very, very pleased because the goals that he had when he did these various trusts, the community development one, which you're referring to, still exists and gives grants regularly. The educational one, which continues to give grants, which is still much appreciated and needed. The Confederation Center one, which was very important at the time they were trying to get the thing built because it was one of those pivotal grants that swung the scale, shall we say. And he would appreciate that very, very much. There were others that he did as well. I think he would look around and say, yeah, that was good. I think he would be. And I think it's also important that we adhere to the vision that he had, or the vision that any benefactor has. It's very important. And if potential future benefactors, Paul, have confidence that the public of PEI will have that in their mind, I think we might even see some more of that sort of thing.
Well, just because 40 or 50 or 100 years have passed doesn't diminish the importance of the gift in the first place or the reasons for it. Yeah, when you read the trusts, and I've read the trust documents, I mean, they are very stringent in terms of where the money can go, what percentage can be spent, what percentage has to be reinvested. Very clear in terms of their vision, which has got to be ahead of its time.
Oh, I think so. Yes, he was a visionary. He was progressive. He was all those sorts of things. But he was also a funny looking little man. He was a very small man. One of the last times I saw him, he was climbing up a big long ladder with a tar pot in his hand. He always wore a bowler hat and a hammer, and he was going up to repatch a roof. He, in bowler hat, shirt and tie, a hammer in hand. And that's the last time I remember seeing him. Well, how could I ever forget? It was a vision. And there are other things about him that your audience might appreciate understanding. He was a very wealthy man, but he never bought a new car. He always bought a second-hand car. He was always a Studebaker. And My father used to splutter every time he'd come up with a new used car. It spluttered that perhaps he couldn't have gone and popped one, a nice new one for himself. But no, couldn't do that. His own house, he kept a beautiful garden around it. It was across the street from where I grew up, so I was very familiar with that. And he personally did a lot of the gardening. He had rose gardens there that were spectacular. And he was looking after them. He had a vegetable garden, flowers and shrubs and so on around his house on what is now Century Place Street, off Brighton Road. I'm trying to paint a picture of a man who was very plain in his tastes personally. He was a very good citizen, and that is to say he did things which good citizens should do, like he served on the hospital board. I think he was chairman of the hospital board. And he was very active in supporting his parish church. He was on the vestry committee for many, many years. And so he did all sorts of good citizen type things that all of us should take a swing at, help out with. And meantime, he had was making all this money and scheming in his head what will happen to the money, because he had no children. He had grand nephews that he could have, but he didn't. And so I have a very positive opinion about Uncle Bobby. He made a lot of money, and I think he did it honestly. He dodged a lot of taxes, which I always respect legally, and he got the money into the hands of the province of Prince Edward Island for the benefit of Islanders, and the evidence is in. It's working.
Do you think Islanders should know more about Robert L. Cotton and his impact on how we all live?
It would be helpful, because the man had a sense of who he was. He had a sense of who we are in Little Prince Edward Island. And he had a sense of the future by his own investments. And he was always thinking about the future. So I should think, yes, there's a lot of lessons to be learned from a life like his.
Well, that's a wrap for episode 3 of Because Life is Local. Thanks to our sponsor, Kent Scales and Robin's Donuts. Drop by any one of the Robin locations across PEI. In these difficult times, it's more important than ever to support island business that supports you. Thanks to Fred Hyman for sharing stories of his uncle Robert L. Cotton. I'm Paul McNeil, and you've been listening to Because Life is Local.